Going to call to order the Tuesday, February 19th, 2013 session of the House Agriculture and Natural Resources Committee. We are in order. Good morning to everyone. We had on our schedule a work session. Representative McEwen has some business first thing this morning, so I'm going to wait until she gets back for introduction of LC 1006. And we're going to move on to the public hearing portion of our agenda. I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2039. And Beth, if you could please tell us briefly what that bill's about.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2039 creates and modifies provisions related to the regulation of outfitting and guiding services. There's no revenue impact. There may be a fiscal impact, but there's been no statement received, and it has a subsequent referral to the Joint Ways and Means Committee.
Very good. And with that, I'm going to call up, please, Scott Bruin, Randy Henry, and Brian Carroll. Good morning, gentlemen.
Good morning.
Please feel free to proceed.
Okay. Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Scott Bruin, Director of the Oregon State Marine Board. Now, we're here before you this morning to talk about House Bill 2039. This is a bill that impacts guides and outfitters in Oregon. I have provided written testimony for you, which has some appendices to that, which includes the Guide Advisory Committee that we used throughout this process to discuss the issues with. Also included is a summary, kind of section by section, of the changes that are a part of this bill. A comparison of our fees to other Western states, what they charge, and a quick overview of the 2012 Outfitter and Guide Law Enforcement Pilot Project Summary. So those are some pieces for you. We'll be talking a little bit about some of that as well this morning. So Randy Henry is our Boating Safety Manager. Brian Carroll is the Vice Chair of our board that are up here with me this morning.
Very good.
So in 1984, the Oregon State Marine Board began management and oversight of the Outfitter and Guide Program. In 1987, charter vessels were added. And in 1993, the legislature adopted laws requiring a decal system for guide boats and vehicles to assist in tracking illegal guiding. The Outfitter and Guide Program functions as a basic registration program which ensures guides are registered, insured, bonded, and have current first aid certifications. I will say that guiding and outfitting is an important industry in Oregon. It's something that we take a lot of pride in. These are the people that take folks that perhaps don't get out in the outdoors more. It's not just fishing and hunting, but it's also whitewater rafting. It's hiking, bicycling, youth guiding. So within that framework of outfitting and guiding are quite a few different professions. But like any profession, there are those that abide by the rules, and there are those that do things illegally, either illegal guiding or they operate illegally. And so in 2010, as a result of numerous complaints, we put together the Guide Advisory Committee. The Guide Advisory Committee is actually set up in statute as the group that should provide us advice on guides and outfitters. However, in statute, some of those guiding groups no longer exist or are a shell of themselves. So we got together the larger guiding groups as part of this committee, and as I said, I included who was represented in our handout. So in January 2011, we put together the Guide Advisory Committee. We also mailed out a survey to the 1,200 guides that we have in Oregon, asking them a number of questions, and we had 10 regional meetings throughout the state to find out what we needed to do to partner with them to deal with some of the issues that we were seeing, that they see on a day-to-day basis. And I think from a general perspective, what the Guide Advisory Committee said is, as we care for our industry, we care to make sure that our industry is professional, that the people that participate in our industry are professional and are at a standard that we can be proud of, and that the people that use our services can be proud of as well. So this bill is a reflection of the work that was done with that group and what was taken to our board and what was approved for our board to move forward. So some things in this bill. The bill will increase the current $300,000 minimum liability insurance to $500,000. This is more of an industry standard that we've seen around the country, and many of the guides already have that higher liability insurance. Beginning in 2014, the fees would increase from $50 to $150 per year. The increase will fund improved program oversight, outreach efforts, and law enforcement, specifically targeting illegal guiding activities. So though it is a multiplicative increase, the fee remains small compared to other states and will result in measurable improvements to program implementation. So all persons functioning as a fishing guide will be required to register as a guide. So currently, a registered guide may hire employees to work under his or her registration, creating enforcement and tracking loopholes. So furthermore, a guide whose registration is revoked can continue to practice guiding as an employee of another guide with little impact to his or her operation. So several key law enforcement investigations illustrate the need for this change. Full registration of all individuals who function as fishing guides will provide more accurate data to the agency and would increase revenues to fund law enforcement goals. Another piece to this bill is this bill would require all guides operating motorboats at any time during the year to carry a minimum of a U.S. Coast Guard operator of an uninspected passenger vessel, which is called a six-pack inland license. This law would phase in over a five-year time period. A couple of reasons that the Guide Advisory Committee moved this forward and the board approved it, and we're bringing it to you. Establishing higher professional standards for guides operating motorboats. So a guide must demonstrate the knowledge to pass the U.S. Coast Guard test, a physical exam, and submit to random drug testing. It would prevent individuals with drug violations from continuing operation on inland waters. And it would address public concern for safety and knowledge. So similar to a public acceptance of a commercial driver's license, this would have guides up at a higher standard than the general public for what they've achieved in as an operator of boats. The caveat to the Coast Guard license requirement pertains to rafting guides who use a motor occasionally to move rafts across flat water at the end of a whitewater trip. As I discussed, the Guide Advisory Committee membership is in statute. We'd like to move that to rule because guide organizations come and go, and it'd be easier for the board to designate who those groups are for that at Guide Advisory Committee. The bill will also upgrade violations for failure to comply from Class B misdemeanors to Class A misdemeanors. So I'd like to go ahead and turn it over to Mr. Henry. He's going to talk a little bit about our pilot project that we worked with state police on to look at some of the issues that were coming to the Marine Board that frankly, under the current registration amount, we don't have the money to fund these type of activities. We had some additional funding that we used for this pilot project and some of what we saw as a result.
Thank you, Chair Witt, members of the committee. The pilot project was something that was actually, it evolved out of those regional meetings that we had across the state. Some of the areas, especially in Southwest and Southern Oregon, and Northwest also, reported a large number of illegal guides, whether they were unlicensed guides, out-of-state guides who didn't have their proper state credentials, or people who just took the term trip sharing to mean that they could help fund the purchase of their boats and vehicles. There were a lot of concerns out there. There was also concerns about operations, individuals who had committed significant violations and hadn't been held accountable for those in relation to their guide licenses. As we worked through that, we made the suggestion, several of us started thinking about, well, we don't know what the scope of the violations are. We don't really know what good tools are out there to address the violations. So we started talking with state police and with some of the other guides and the county sheriffs as well. How would you get your arms around this? We were able to identify some one-time funds. We talked to state police. We eventually ended up coordinating with their special investigations folks within their Fish and Wildlife Division. And we put together an interagency agreement for $5,000, specifically to focus on the North Coast and the South Coast areas, Tillamook Bay areas, and then also South Coast. We were having a number of complaints and problems on the South Fork, Coquille, the Sixes, the Elk, the Chetco down there. If you spend time on the South Coast fishing, you know that winter steelhead is in a very intense period, a lot of people competing for the same water. And guides tend to set the tone. The way they fish is how everybody else wants to fish because they're effective. So if you get guides or unlicensed guides who are overly aggressive, confrontational, that begins to create some problems. And that was another aspect of the pilot project that we wanted to address. So we worked together to develop this interagency agreement, and then we turned it over to state police. And they started doing the undercover work, and Lieutenant David Anderson is here and can address some of those details. But in a nutshell, they were able to use the resources that we provided to go out and try to book some trips, to observe some folks that we had gotten specific complaints about, and carry those through. It was a tool that we really had never used before, and it was useful in a number of ways. And I'll give you a couple of examples here, but some things that we learned from that were quite useful. Probably 80% of the complaints that we get against guides are unfounded, or there's no supporting data. That's, I think, good news for the guide industry. We can say that the bulk of them are law-abiding. Some of them are just very good at their craft and what they do, and they catch a number of fish, and that concerns some people. But about 20% of them are problematic, and that 20% takes special time that uniformed officers just can't get to. Uniformed officers do a great job. They serve a very important purpose. But for some of those 20% who are good at being unlicensed guides or don't want to play by the rules, they've coached their clients, they know how to get around the rules, and it really takes a plainclothes officer to be out there and to book a trip and to observe from the boat ramp and that sort of thing. So that was some useful data right there that we learned over the course of a year. One example that I want to give, though, of a particular case is shortly after we started this, I received some complaints, I guess this was in April of last year, from some guides on the South Coast in the Tillamook area, Nehalem area, of a guide who was very brazenly taking clients, accepting payments from the boat dock, from the launch area, and taking people out on the water. I forwarded this to the Special Investigations folks, and they carried it from there. And the way this unfolded was they worked with their local uniformed officers who had observed similar situations but couldn't essentially make the case. They worked to book a trip. They worked to observe some of the activities. They ended up arresting the person or citing the person for over-harvest, keeping wild fish, several other violations that actually resulted in this person serving a short jail time. This was particularly enlightening because this person was an unlicensed guide. This person had been a guide at one point in their lives. This person had a Coast Guard license. I believe it had lapsed at the time, but it has since been reinitiated. So this person had a valid Coast Guard license. And what this came to illustrate was this individual, who served some jail time, is essentially out of luck to be a guide in Oregon. But that's okay. He can now be a charter operator because charter operators, we don't look into their fish and wildlife violations. So there's another bill, House Bill, Senate Bill 25, that's going to address some of the issues with charter operations. But this led us down the whole road of trying to look at this person would have been a six-pack operator, an uninspected passenger vessel. This helped us draw the line of bringing everybody who's currently a six-pack operator back to the outfitter guide program, so we can have them under these rules because a number of the operators of these uninspected passenger vessels that operate in the ocean are either under the charter program exclusively or are both charters and guides. And this bill will specifically pull them back into the outfitter guide program. Seven or more, you'll be in the charter program. Six or less, you'll be in the outfitter guide program. But this was one of those cases that really helped illustrate a number of reasons, helped support a number of the points that were in this bill. There were other cases where state police were able to book trips or to start booking trips and to show that there were violations in the advertising standards. You're not supposed to advertise as an outfitter guide if you're not a licensed outfitter guide. The bulk of the cases that they began investigating, I think 31 overall, turned out to not lead to specific violations, but some of them did. They took extra time. Some of those are ongoing. And that's kind of a summary of the project. It was very instructive in helping us learn the tools that are available, how to use them better, and it also helped instruct us on some internal things we need to do to provide better information to law enforcement, both to the uniformed county officers and the state police as well. I'll answer any questions if you like.
Thank you very much. Is Mr. Carroll, are you testifying?
I Chair Witt, members of the committee, for the record, Brian Carroll, Vice Chair of the Marine Board. And I'm just here to more or less answer questions and let you know that the board did unanimously support moving this measure forward, and the staff has done quite a bit of research on this.
So, great. Thank you very much. Questions or comments for our panel? Representative Whitsitt.
Thank you, Chair. I noticed that it says outdoor recreational activities including but not limited to, and then there's a list. And I was wondering if you consider, these are some of the things that occur in my district, bird watching, where they guide bird watching, because we have these national refuges. So we have people that are paid for that. And then you talk about advertising in there, too, if you're not a licensed guide, and yet you're taking people on these trips down into the refuges and things. Also, dog sledding is a big thing up around Chemult in Klamath County. And so I just want to make sure what we're considering guiding and what we're not, so people don't fall into the not included or not inclusive part.
Thank you. Chair Witt, Representative Whitsitt, we're not looking to expand the definitions at all through this. Guiding is when you take, when you're making a profit, taking people into the wilderness. If you're an educational institution, such as, I believe Lane Community College does regular rafting trips down the river, and they take people out. And those fees that they recover are to cover the cost of the program, and they're part of an institution, so they're not considered a guide. Most of the bird watchings, Audubon and those sorts of folks that take people out, if there's a fee involved, it's to defray the cost of the trip, and there's not an individual making a profit, so they wouldn't qualify as a guide. But if a person is making a profit, taking people out into the wilderness, if you were taking people on a bicycle ride, through the desert and making enough money to pay your bills and make a living at it, then you would need to be considered a guide. There are some gray areas out there. Bird watching, I don't know specifically if we have bird watching. Most of those are tied to organizations, or the fees are so small that they're basically covering costs. We do have some questions regarding organizations that have fundraising trips and take people out, and they're specifically making money to help support their organization. At that point, we would work with them and ask them to register as a guide if we felt that met that definition.
Follow-up. So probably you wouldn't essentially find someone the first time that they did this if they fell into that gray area then. You might warn them. We have bike and mountain bike people that go out, and I mean, these things are huge in our district. So,
Chair Witt, Representative Whitsitt. Typically what we do, if there's something in the gray area, we'll contact the person and say, do you realize, or we'll just call them to get more information about exactly what they're doing, and then provide them the opportunity to register. In some cases where it's pretty clear they're taking, rafting trips or fishing trips and they're making money, then we won't necessarily have that conversation.
Well, thank you.
Thank you. Representative Krieger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Absolutely.
Get around this a little bit, and Mr. Henry was in my room the other day. I just want to make sure people understand you were talking about crowding on the South Coast, Chetco, Elk River. The Elk River's had 100 drift boats on it in one day, not counting bank anglers. You end up with social problems, people not being polite, their interaction of that many people on a limited size stream, you end up with social problems. Mm-hmm. It's something we tried to get the Department of Fish and Wildlife to understand, that if you do that long enough, pretty soon you got a natural resource problem, because you start having an unnatural, unsustainable impact on those runs of fish, and before you can identify it, you've got a huge problem. So I can make that part of the record, that does happen. And Mr. Chair, you know, this is one of the few times I might say I really support the increased fee. Oregon is extremely low. I think if you talk to the guides, you'll find out the majority of them support that fee increase, much lower than other states. And you can't go into any other natural resource, whether it's commercial fishing or anything there is, and for a $50 bill, go out and make your living. They need to step up, and I think they want to step up, and it'll help the department be able to do their job. One other thing, under Section 4, page 3, down lines 29, where you're conferring wanting these people to have a Coast Guard license, so the state is requiring someone to have a federal license, and you're expanding federal authority on non-navigable water, having them have oversight. I always have a little bit of a problem anytime we expand the federal government doing anything. So it's just a thought. And I always try to make Representative Olson happy, because if you have game enforcement officers who are having difficulty, I've done that, standstills in the audience, but we normally tell them, if they can't do their job in the game division, just put them in a patrol car and they can chase taillights.
Chair Whip, Representative Kruger, may I respond to one of the comments you made? In regards to the social and biological impact, that was certainly what led us, I think, to this initial discussion, especially on the South Fork Coquille. That was a particular instance where we were petitioned to prohibit motors on a section of the river. And as we looked at it, the petition was eventually voted down. But when we looked into that, what we really saw was a big chunk of that conflict was between guides and non-guides. Guides are very good at knowing when a river is fishable and when the fish are there, when the water's just right, and they all show up. And a number of guides that come to that area are from urban areas where they're used to high-pressure fishing, I guess, so it kind of borders on combat fishing sometimes. They're very aggressive. They put their folks on a lot of fish during the day. And that led to some of the conflict and confrontation that we saw on the Coquille, and I think the same thing that we see on the Chetco and some of the other areas. And that was part of the rationale of going through this program and raising the bar, so to speak, is to let the guides know that they're professionals, and when they take people out onto the water, they're teaching them how to fish and how to act, and we need to improve the ethical conduct of outfitters and guides and try to provide them a little bit more of a unified voice that doesn't exist out there. It's a very fractured industry right now. And they came to us saying, we recognize that we're kind of in a shambles. We'd like a voice. We'd like to improve our professional conduct. There was mixed feelings among the group on whether to go to limited entry, which was suggested in a bill that Representative Krieger introduced in 2009, where you would actually limit the number of fishing guides or guides on certain waterways. And the discussion in the group was, you know, we may end up there, but for now, let's just tighten the reins and make this group more professional and spend a few years trying to deal with it ourselves. And if we need to go there, we'll go there. But let's spend a few years getting our house in order before we take that road. And this is largely a product of that discussion.
Follow up. The Department of Fish and Wildlife has a new multi-species thing on the coast where they're reducing a lot of the plants of hatchery fish. So those areas that do have hatchery fish that are going to be the catchable fish, in some places you can't keep the others or you're limited to 5 a year depending where you are, do you think that now if that happens and the guys want to produce, are you going to cause shift in effort onto those streams that have the hatchery fish? South Fork would be a good example. We're taking them off making wild fish out of the rest of those streams. Do you think it's going to cause some shift?
Chair Whip, Representative Krieger, it probably will. It's hard to tell what the cause and effect of those are. Part of the related to the multi-species management is the reason they're moving the deadline on the Siletz down towards the Ojala Bridge, which reduces the area that you can fish for Chinook and compresses drift boats into a shorter section, into a 6-mile section, and increases user conflict. And we have some issues before us right now related to motorboat operation on that section of the water. Sometimes, I think building this program would help keep us in tune with what Fish and Wildlife is doing. We've tried to include Fish and Wildlife in the conversations. Well, we have included Fish and Wildlife in these conversations. I know a lot of those biologists, and I call them first when we have a guide issue come up to get a sense of what their take is on it. Obviously, they manage the biological impacts, but a lot of times they'll have sensitivity to the social impacts of those, and that helps the discussion. But it would be nice if we could forecast a little bit where we think those changes are going to be so we could adjust as necessary. And that's communications that we can improve upon.
Thank you.
I would like to call on Vice Chair Esquivel and Representative Whitsett on deck.
Thank you. It's not like a baseball lineup.
Yeah. Will this, in fact, with the requirement for the Coast Guard license, will that in fact allow the Coast Guard to have more jurisdiction, and not only more jurisdiction, but have the ability to go up into our tributaries and our rivers to enforce laws at that point?
Chair Witt, Representative Esquivel. No, it would not. The Coast Guard license would, they would be achieving a certain level of licensure, but it wouldn't give the Coast Guard specific authority to enforce off of the areas where they enforce, nor is there really any desire to do so. I think getting back to Representative Krieger's question about the Coast Guard license, this was something we spent a lot of time going back and forth having a discussion, because there was a desire to achieve, I think, a higher level of operational expertise by this group, or at least some sort of a certification that showed that. And we talked about having it in-house at the Marine Board, but such a large number of fishing guides already have a Coast Guard license. We would be adding additional pieces to what we do and adding to them to try to do something in-house in addition to the Coast Guard requirement that already exists for many guides that operate in federally navigable waters. So the license is something that they would carry that would show that they've achieved a certain level, but it wouldn't give the Coast Guard authority. It's not a boat license or an inspection license. It's simply showing that the operators met a certain level of expertise.
Please.
Now, thank you for the explanation. Now, how are you going to do this random drug testing? Are you going to do that whenever people sign up, or are you just going to call them up and say, Joe, get in here, we're going to have you do random drug testing? Or how does that work? Because and what percentage of the people, recipients of license, the full license, will that encompass in a year? Because, I mean, you're saying here, prevents individuals from drug violation from continuing operation on inland waters.
So, Chair Witt, Vice Chair Esquivel, so I have a Coast Guard license. So when I renew my license, I have two options. Either the company that I work for submits a letter that says that I have, that I go through random drug testing, or I go to a drug testing lab. The labs are throughout the state of Oregon, similar to what a commercial operator for a truck would go to, and you go in and go to those labs to do that. So there's two options.
Every time anyone renews their license, they have to go through a drug testing?
The only time I have to do it is when I renew my license. They have you go through that upon renewal. That doesn't mean that they don't have the opportunity, I don't believe, to have you go through and provide a sample to them at other times.
Thank you.
But it is through the Coast Guard that would be done through, not through the state.
I appreciate that. Thank you. Thank you. Representative Whitsett.
Thank you. In eastern Oregon, there are a lot of large ranches, and sometimes the owners sell the right to hunt on their ranches for birds or mammals, large game animals. And maybe you could clarify, are those landowners who sell the right to hunt birds or mammals, are they required to be licensed as a guide if they travel out and show the people where the birds are or where the mammals are?
Chair Witt, Representative Whitsett. I don't believe they do. If the requirement for a guide is, or a guide is exempt from the guide statute if they either own or are in control of the property upon which they guide. So if they present to us a lease that they are guiding on a 1,000-acre ranch near Heppner, then they would not be required to be a guide. If they guided off of that on public lands, they would be required to have a guide. The owner of the property, again, it's a private land control. I'm very sure they wouldn't need to be registered as a guide.
Okay. All right. Thanks.
Anything further?
good discussion.
It was a very good discussion. And before the panel leaves, I just want to recognize the fact that the Marine Board has jurisdiction over our guides and outfitters, and I think you're taking your job very seriously. I think you're trying to professionalize the entire operation, not only your own, but that which you oversee, and I want to thank you for the very, very excellent job that you're providing here for the state. Thank you.
Thank you.
With that, I'd like to call up, please, David Anderson, OSP. Welcome to our committee, Lieutenant.
Good morning. Thank you, and good morning.
Good morning.
Chair Witt, members of the committee, for the record, my name is David Anderson. Lieutenant with the Oregon State Police, assigned to the Fish and Wildlife Division, and I currently manage our fisheries enforcement program, as well as oversee our Special Investigations Unit. I'm here today testifying in support of House Bill 2039. We feel that the statutory amendments within this bill will not only improve enforcement effort and effectiveness, but also benefit legitimate law-abiding guides and outfitters. As well as Oregon citizens and visitors that contract with guides and outfitters for services. Some examples within the bill that will benefit these groups include providing a definition for costs or expenses for a trip. Current statutory language states in substance that outfitting and guiding services are not offered or provided for compensation if the only money exchanged is for the sharing of the costs or expenses of the trip. However, the statute does not define what those costs are, leaving it open to interpretation, something from our experience that unlicensed guides have taken advantage of. House Bill 2039 provides what are and what are not allowable costs or legitimate costs for a guide outfitter trip. Another example is requiring employees of guides and outfitters to carry proof of registration. There have been several occasions where law enforcement have contacted individuals with clients in the field who have stated that they are guiding and that they are an employee of a guide. So the law enforcement will take down the information and let the person continue on his or her activity and then check later with the Marine Board to confirm the information, only to find out that they are in fact not an employee of a guide. This causes our trooper or other law enforcement to then track down this individual, which takes time, and take the appropriate law enforcement action. House Bill 2039 will eliminate this inefficiency by requiring each of these employees to carry proof of registration. Another benefit of this could be a benefit for legitimate guides and outfitters. Unlicensed guides would have a more difficult time enlisting clients under the guise that they are an employee of a legitimate guide. Clients could then ask to see a registration from any person that offers guiding and outfitting services, even if that person is an employee. We also believe that increasing the penalty level from a Class B to a Class A misdemeanor could provide an increased deterrent and brings the penalty level for violating the guide and outfitter laws in line with that of the Fish and Wildlife laws, which are also Class A misdemeanors. This makes sense to enforcement, since many of the guide and outfitters are marketing their services towards the attempted take of fish and wildlife. Getting caught would no longer just be the price of doing business. The penalty is higher. And lastly, the registration requirement of having no felony or misdemeanor conviction related to outdoor recreational activities within the last 24 months. This is a benefit in that clients place a great deal of trust in a guide and outfitter. They expect a guide and outfitter or employee of that guide and outfitter to have the same respect for the law that they do, something that someone that will not put them in jeopardy of a fish or wildlife violation. This additional language will help ensure that Oregon's guides are reputable and have the best interests of their clients in mind. Mr. Henry spoke a little bit to the pilot project that we had and our Special Investigations Unit and how we looked into the guide and outfitter issues that were ongoing. I used to work within our special investigations unit, so I'm very familiar with it and how effective it is. It's a plainclothes unit, trained specifically in undercover fish and wildlife work. They handle generally the very large, complex cases that our field force does not have the time for, generally involving the commercialization of wildlife, sturgeon caviar, bear parts, etc. They were very instrumental in this pilot project. We dedicated one of the detectives to it for a time. That project reaffirmed much of what we already knew, which when it came to unlicensed guides or illegal guiding activity, undercover work was highly effective. From my own experience, I know that an unlicensed guide usually takes people that he or she trusts, or they are very good at coaching the clients to say the appropriate things at the ramp. Very quickly, a story from when I worked in the unit, we had received numerous complaints, or our uniformed troopers had, of an unlicensed guide working a very well-known river for steelhead. And they had contacted this individual at the ramp several times, always with different people. And they all said the same thing. This is a recreational trip. So my partner and I worked diligently to gain this individual's trust and booked a trip and spent the entire day with him. And towards the end of the trip, he got rather quiet and said, went into a very long story. It was very compelling about he had forgotten to make his insurance payment and his license had lapsed for 2 days and he was going to make that payment as soon as he got home. Based on the investigation, I knew that already to be not true by a long way. He had not been licensed in quite some time. But if I had not been enforcement and had not known that information, his story was very compelling. He was taken care of appropriately and received the appropriate fines through the court system. Another thing we learned, it was very useful to have a dedicated detective to serve as a go-between between the Marine Board and enforcement. Illegal guides move around. They don't stay in one area. This officer could serve as a hub of information, if you will, a clearinghouse, where information was coming in from local law enforcement, county and state, and tracking the movements of these individuals. So we support House Bill 2039. We believe it's a good bill that will benefit clients, legitimate guide and outfitters, Marine Board, and enforcement. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Questions or comments for Lieutenant Anderson, Vice Chair Esquivel?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. On compensation, I've been told, I never witnessed it, but I've been told that the Game Enforcement, your division, has even told people that if I went fishing with Brad, I couldn't build Brad's pickup with fuel, even though he's using his fuel. I think that's kind of a stretch, if that's the case, and I would recommend you don't pursue that.
Chair Witt, Vice Chair Esquivel, that's a very good recommendation.
Okay.
I don't believe that is happening, and the bill actually specifically
does. I've heard it on the rogue. And by the way, the guy's transferred out.
Okay. So the bill actually does list fuel as one of the items allowed for cost sharing.
Well, it didn't in those days, evidently.
Yeah,
so the other thing is, speaking of the Rogue River, and you are in charge of that, who decided that we wouldn't allow people to fish down below the dam after 7 o'clock there at the hatchery?
Chair Witt, Vice Chair.
I've had so many calls on that, you wouldn't believe it.
I know a little bit about that, so I'll attempt to answer your question the best I can. I believe the property is owned by the Corps, and there's a lot of social issues there. So the Corps of Engineers set it up to where they can come in a little earlier, because I think it used to not open. The area can be gated, and it used to not open when fishing hours actually began. So they kind of changed it to where they're opening earlier, but closing a little earlier.
I understand it's an enforcement problem. We can handle an enforcement problem, I would think. And that's what I've been told it is, an enforcement problem.
Chair Witt, Vice Chair Esquivel, I can definitely gather more information on it.
I appreciate that.
I will do that and get back to you.
And the reason being is because they're allowed to fish there until 7 o'clock. after 7, they have to leave, which I'm going, okay, what's the magic hour? Do you turn into a pumpkin or what? But on the other hand, we're taking those fish from the fatchery and transporting them back down to Tuvel Park and dropping them back into the water so they get a second shot at them coming up. And then we continue to do that throughout the whole season. And to me, that doesn't make sense.
Chair Witt, Representative Escobar, that's probably an Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife.
I'm sure.
I can't speak from my experience working the field on the Hood River, where I was based for over a decade. They had a similar issue where they would continually take fish from the weir and put them back at the mouth, and it was a lot to do with the wild fish policy of only putting a certain amount of hatchery fish over the weir. But again, I...
Okay, thank you. As for getting a guide out here, you've got someone that said I'm working for Clem here, and he's a guide, and I'm his employee.
Shouldn't I've fished with him before.
Well, I rest my case. should we not have a registration of this individual where we could radio in and find out if I were legitimate?
Chair Witt, Vice Chair Escobar, that would be excellent. Of course, the House Bill 2039 does now require employees to carry a card.
I mean, the relevant of that.
Yes.
It would be like a driver's license. If you stop me, you can radio in and you can tell whether I have a suspended or non-suspended license.
Chair Witt, Vice Chair Escobar, that would be very beneficial. Even an online system where our troopers now carry mobile data terminals in their vehicles, and so if they could go back to the vehicle and get online and look in the database, which probably can happen, and we would be able to check on that.
Okay, but I guess I don't understand why I have to carry something if you have that data available to you.
Well, Chair Witt, Vice Chair Escobar, many times we're not near our vehicles where we have access to that. A lot of guides and outfitters operate in very remote locations.
Mm, that's true.
Where, quite frankly, communication is not possible.
Okay. You're not in radio contact?
There are some places where we are not in radio contact, sir.
And by the way, I want to know, when you stung this guy, did you catch anything?
Chair Witt, Vice Chair Escobar, I believe 2 fish were caught and released on that day.
Oh, catch and release, okay. Thank you.
Representative Clem.
I don't even know how to follow that. I'm interested in the way the bill's drafted, and something you said along with our paper that we've got, mentioning the felony and misdemeanor revocation, triggering potentially suspension or revocation based on felonies or misdemeanors related to wildlife laws. And that was the way the statute definitely read before. It said basically that if there was a person convicted of a violation of ORS such and such, and I assume those were all wildlife laws. Now it reads, in the proposed language, it reads, when a person is convicted of a felony or misdemeanor, comma, a violation of such and such, and then down below it says the board may reprimand an outfitter or revoke for any of the following: conviction of a felony or misdemeanor, period, then any serious or repeated. So it looks to me like the way that LC wrote this, you could have it revoked for any misdemeanor of any kind, not just wildlife laws. I don't think that's intentional based on what you said and what this said, but I want to clarify if that is intentional, and we should at least understand that, because that's, I mean, anything.
Chair Witt, Representative Clem, I actually believe that the Marine Board could answer that question better than I can.
Okay, sure.
And I would leave that to them.
Okay.
Thank you.
Representative, would you like to call back?
Yeah, well, when we're done with this, maybe.
Representative Krieger?
I was kind of proud of the lieutenant's comments when he was able to say that the problem is the problem for the Department of Fish and Wildlife. That is the right answer. The second thing is, I wanted to apologize because you were sitting in the back of the room and I profiled you because you had a smirk on your face when I said those guys can go chase taillights.
I thought the comment was anyone could chase taillights.
You notice he's not saying much.
Additional questions or comments for Lieutenant Anderson? Thank you very, very much. Appreciate your testimony.
Thank you, and have a good day.
Thank you. I hope you do as well. With that, please stand still. And is it Doug Caver?
Caven.
Welcome, gentlemen.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I'm Doug Caven, President of McKenzie River Guides Association.
Please proceed.
McKenzie River Guides Association has reviewed this legislation, and we support the legislation as it's written. We believe that the increases in fees are very reasonable and prudent, and the fact that they're going for enforcement is really a good thing from the experience we've had on the river and out there doing the jobs that we do. So we think that's a real positive thing. We think that the raise in liability insurance requirements is also prudent risk management policy, and a lot of us carry significantly more than that because we all know that you know, $300,000 or even $500,000 will barely pay the attorneys, let alone medical costs. And the application of the motor requirements and Coast Guard licensing for operating boats with motors, applying consistently to all waters, is a good way to manage that system.
Great.
Good morning, Chairman Witt, members of the committee.
Good morning.
I'm Stan Steele. Representing Krieger and I used to work somewhat together. I was a fish and wildlife officer for 25 years, and actually worked a lot of guide enforcement in the rivers that area geographically that I was responsible for. We had salmon and steelhead and year-round salmon and steelhead. So consequently, with that, you are going to be involved in what is most generally known as Oregon's guide industry, as well as I became a member of the McKenzie Guides Association when I was 18, so I've been around this thing for a long time now, as you can see, getting old and gray. But it's very important that we understand that guiding does provide a basic service to Oregon, and it's many, many thousands of jobs and multipliers that go with that industry. It is actually a very crucial and important part to Oregon tourism. One of the main things that we have to sell that people love from Europe, I've had people from France, I've had people from pretty much everywhere, every continent. After I retired, I went into my guiding business. It was kind of a second thing to go to. And people love Oregon. They're just amazed at the sights, the sounds, and the smells, the stuff that we often just take for granted. So the guide industry, many guides are our best ambassadors. They are an incredible ambassador for outdoor Oregon and Oregon in general. So how we govern that is an extremely important component. I really do agree with Representative Krieger when I think one of the most crucial things for Oregon to do is internalize and not allow the federal government to dictate enforcement of our important natural resources and how we look at those and how we utilize those. I think we can look at many, many federal programs and understand from cormorants to sea lions, we have problems when the federal government comes involved. So I would like to see the Marine Board internalize the drug testing program, because what goes on with that program, there's a little bit of information that I kind of disagree with. When you have a Coast Guard license, or what's referred to as six-pack license, one of the requirements is that you belong to a drug consortium. You are randomly selected when you're in that consortium to go in for a drug test. We don't require that for the Oregon State Police Fish and Wildlife Troopers. So it is an important component to consider. And you are randomly selected. One year I was chosen three times because I belong to a small consortium. So we have to make sure that, let's internalize that step. Six-pack licenses can be an educational process and a requirement that professionalize our industry. But we can do it through the Marine Board, not through the U.S. Coast Guard. And what that means is we are going to have state control and state supervision. And when we feel a change is needed, we can work with the state. So I think keeping it there would be really good. Otherwise, enforcement is a needed criteria for all new regulations that we propose. And without adequate enforcement funding, guides are just going to continue, or unscrupulous weekenders are just going to continue to do their thing. So for us to enact new legislation or intensify the legislation that's already here, enforcement has to be budgeted for. With that, though, this is a great piece of work, and the groups that I work with, the Oregon Outdoor Council, the LC Sportsman's Association, and the McKenzie River Guides, highly recommend passage of House Bill 2039. Thank you.
Thank you very, very much. Questions or comments for this panel? Stan, I just you really brought it home for me when you mentioned cormorants and sea lions. I think I have a better feel for the challenges that federal government imposes on us. I think I'd probably add terns and a few other a few other problem makers as well, but that example really brings it home to me. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Representative Clem.
Mr. Chair, I'm going to waste a seat from the union.
Everyone laughing. Is that in order?
Vice Chair Esquivel.
Mr. Chair, not only do I agree with Representative Clem on that issue, but I'd like to, see us cut out the state of Jefferson as well, if we possibly could.
Additional questions? Yes, Representative Krieger, please. I know we've started something here.
But it doesn't matter where you look with the federal government. You know, you and I enforce the Endangered Species Act, the Marine Mammal Act. It turns into a quagmire of bureaucracy that those agencies themselves don't understand. And when you go to fix something within the system, it's a multi-10-year thing, and by the time you start down the track, the guy who's working with, he has already retired, and you just never get there. And you see it with our forest management plan at the federal level today, constant lawsuits in the courtroom, men in black robes making decisions. That isn't how you should manage natural resources.
Well, Representative Krieger and Sherwood and members of the committee, yesterday I spent an extreme amount of time, matter of fact, pretty much 10 hours, reviewing several White House proclamations and thinking, how can we utilize those in getting Oregon back into the hunting, fishing, and trapping economies? There's been so many commissions and panels and special groups and all of this that I'm bringing to Representative Esquivel today a notebook that is nearly 3 inches thick. All of these are presidential panels that have been empowered to make sure we can hunt, fish, and trap nationally. And the movement towards that has just been rhetoric. So I look at Oregon as one of the most important things we can do to revitalize Oregon's economy is understand that our natural resources are a prominent commodity. We really can utilize those sustainably with good leadership and create literally hundreds of thousands of jobs and millions of dollars of economic gain. So thank you. That was a little editorial.
Yes, Representative McEwen, please.
On a different note, Mr. Steele, I've had the pleasure of fishing for many, many, many hours out of a beautiful boat that was built by someone that shared your last name. Is that your dad? Okay. Thank you.
Dad's in the Smithsonian in 1976 in Oregon. In the National Bicentennial, they flew my father and mother back to Washington, D.C., and he built Woodruff boat that I have a picture of him floating it on the Washington Monument's reflecting pool. So our history with Oregon Outdoors is rich and long. Thank you very much.
So we're honored to own one of your father's boats.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Gentlemen, thank you so very, very much. And your testimony was not only excellent, but Stan, you gave me a cause to look at things a little differently. Thank you for that.
Thank you.
I would love an opportunity sometime to just sit down and chat. I've enjoyed your testimony very much.
Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Next, I'd like to call up, please, Gary Early and Al Elkins.
Yeah, that's interesting wording in there. Yeah.
good morning to you both. Gary, you're first on the list. Why don't you go first?
Okay, thank you. I appreciate the opportunity to be in front of the committee today, and I have written some things down here. I got to make sure I say them.
All right.
I forget. Okay, my name is Gary Early, and I grew up in Crescent City, and I moved to Oregon in 1990. I've been licensed guide in Oregon, California since 1978, and licensed in Alaska since 1986. I was appointed to the Guide Advisory Committee to deal with the reciprocity in the 90s and again in 2010 when the GAC invoked to deal with pertinent issues relating to licensing. My wife and I have a guide and outfitting business in the Brookings area and fish several rivers along the border area as well as inland rivers. We fish rivers in northern part of the state of California and have a business in Alaska on the Kenai River. Like many other guides, I got into this profession because of my love of fishing and being outdoors. For a long time, I thought the guide industry was too loose, non-professional, and it seems to have its share of bad eggs, which gives the industry in the public's eye a bad reputation. Personally, I feel there was a way to legitimize the profession for the good of the public and the profession, and being in the GAC, we worked hard to represent varying positions with the state while providing a higher standard for guides. Their ethics and safety concern for the public they service. To accomplish this, we've come up with a plan to help enforcement through slightly higher fees, many of which are still significantly lower than other neighboring states. And we've tried to close some loopholes that allow guides with multiple violations and complaints to be held accountable. Many people don't realize what a problem illegal guiding is in our border areas. It's so easy for a California registered guide to jump across the border, school his clients that they aren't really paying, fish the Chetco, Rogue, Elk, Sixes. Those rivers are much more productive. One case in point happened 2 years ago when such event took place, and the guide licensed in California brought his clients to the Chetco, not terribly familiar with the river, followed other boats down the river, hooked a fish, didn't pay attention to a danger in the spot in the river, subsequently dumping the boat, all the passengers. Three of the four people, guide included, made it to shore, but the fourth person hung precariously to a strainer in the middle of the river. Another guide close by rescued that person while other guides contacted 911 to get help. The boat sunk. Nothing could be done because no money had exchanged hands yet. Mm-hmm. This is a common scenario in my area. And added fees for both residents and non-residents would help law enforcement target some of this activity. Another way to raise the bar and provide the public with safer industry is to require all licensed guides running a motorized vessel to have a U.S. Coast Guard license. The public safety benefit of this would be flexibility of operators to move on and off federally navigated waters, and the drug testing requirement would prevent operators to lose their Coast Guard license to drug violations from moving to inland waters. The GIC considered internal non-federal program similar to the Coast Guard license, but ultimately chose this path because it was an existing program with no added cost or complexity to the agency, and thus would allow the fees to be focused on law enforcement. In 1986, I was required by the state of Alaska to have a Coast Guard license to take people on the river for hire. Technically, I should have had one already. I was running big powerboats for hire on federally navigable waters and oceans, and to my surprise, it wasn't that hard to get. I went through proper channels, did a background check, enrolled in sea school. With my experience, ended up with an ocean operator's license. Yes, I had to fill out paperwork. I had to drug test. I had to study and know the laws, but with that procedure, I realized that my responsibility to keeping the public safe, as well as my clients and my boat, put me at a greater risk around other guides who didn't have the proper licensing. We are providing a service, but also setting an example for other boats on the water, and knowledge of the rules and regulations governing our waterways is essential for the public safety and the enjoyment of all. To help with compliance and education of those still needing U.S. Coast Guard licenses, This program would be phased in over 5 years. Coast Guard licenses are good for 5 years and testing only done once, as long as the required time of water is met at renewal time. Random drug testing programs range from $50 to $100 a year, depending on the consortium. All costs of drug testing are paid by the enrolled program. Lastly, I want to ask for your support on tightening the rules that prevent violating guides to move to charter program and vice versa when they lose their licenses. The majority of the six-pack guides focus efforts on the river. If you operate a larger boat for more than six people, then you are running an inspected vessel and are in the ocean charters. That understandable? I mean, you'll have questions, I'm sure.
Absolutely was understandable. And I think more importantly, you gave us some very real-life examples of why this legislation is important. So I'm going to wait until Al's finished his testimony, and we'll open it up and see if we have questions for you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Chair Witt, Vice Chair Escobar, members of the committee, for the record, Al Elkins with the Oregon Hunters Association. We support the bill. We have two members on the advisory committee who have gone through the bill and think it's good to tighten up the program and tighten up the enforcement. We applaud Mr. Henry's efforts in getting the job done. He's taken a 1984 program and brought it to 2013, and this needs to be done. The only question I had, and I think you covered it, was one of the people that reviewed the bill had a question about page 8, section 9, and I think Representative Clem covered that earlier, and we would look forward to that answer as well. So that's the one. That concludes my testimony. I'd be glad to answer any questions.
Very good. Thank you very much. Questions or comments? Gentlemen, thank you very, very much. Appreciate your testimony.
Thank you for your time.
Absolutely. I'd like to call up, please, Joe Rollator and Bob Reese.
Go ahead, Bob.
Bob, your first time before the committee here this year. Great to see you. Welcome.
Thank you. Good morning, Chair Witt, Vice Chair Escobar. My name is Bob Reese, members of the committee. I'm the president of the Northwest Guides and Anglers Association, a 16-year fishing guide liaison to the Northwest Sport Fishing Industry Association, which supports the testimony I'm about to give, which is quite simplistic. Northwest Guides and Anglers Association and NSIA fully support House Bill 2039. I was also a member of the Guide Advisory Committee and applaud the Oregon State Marine Board and Randy Henry for the tremendous amount of work and outreach that was done to create this bill. We believe it's time for our industry to pay for the services provided by the state and the Oregon State Marine Board. It's time for us to become fiscally responsible for the programs that we work under. This bill also brings to a higher standard our guiding industry and eliminates unlicensed guiding. This is a good thing for customer safety and our integrity within our industry. And finally, what I'd like to talk about is the random drug testing program. I've talked with Randy Henry about requiring guides and charters to be enrolled in a random drug testing program. We believe that that is a good thing. And even though it is the federal government that does administer that program, we are, several of my members, including myself, are randomly tested throughout the course of the year. We have to provide, I carry it in my wallet right now, actually, we have to provide proof that we are enrolled in a random drug testing program. And I'd like to see the State Marine Board actually require that proof as well when we are issued our guides licenses on an annual basis. So that's all I have. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Bob, you guide where?
I'm in the northwest corner of the state, both Kennebunk Bay and the Columbia River, as well as all small streams in between.
Thank you very much. Joe?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Joe Rollator. I represent the McKenzie River Guides Association, but I'm here today because I'm the public at-large member of the Guides Advisory Committee. I think you've already heard enough about our deliberations. I've worked with Representative Krieger on this. We've gone through this and back and forth, and I think it's a good bill. And we came to some compromises. And we may want to look at some of the areas in the future. I also have to say I've got a Coast Guard issued license that was first issued in 1972, and it's been renewed several times. And it's a Coast Guard master's license with an international endorsement. And I get called, I've never failed a drug test because I don't drink. And so I get called all the time. I had to drive into Ketchikan one time in my boat and walk up the hill to the hospital to do a random drug testing. But in all effect, I think that's a good thing. And I think Bob's right. So thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Questions or comments for this panel? Yes, Representative Woodslip.
I was wondering if large or otherwise, inland lakes or mountain lakes or upper tributaries to rivers in eastern Oregon will require the guides to have Coast Guard licenses.
Bob, do you want to handle that? You want me to? I can.
Well, I imagine that's a question best asked to the Oregon State Marine Board. My belief is that if you are operating a motorized vessel, that yes, indeed, you have to pass the Coast Guard tests, and you are required to be Coast Guard licensed.
Okay. No follow up. No size on the lakes. Like, we have some small mountain lakes in the Cascades, so that would be the same then.
Chair Wood, Representative Woodsit, I believe that does also apply as long as you are operating a motorized vessel.
And it looks like the Marine Board's giving us an affirmative nod in the back of the room. So, additional questions or comments? Gentlemen, thank you very much. And I want to thank not only you, but all the other guides that have provided testimony here today for the professionalism that you're showing and the fact that you're stepping up to the plate on this bill. It's good job. Thank you very much. We have a couple of other folks that have indicated that they also would like to testify. Trout Unlimited, we have Tom. And Audubon Society, Sue. Is there anyone else from the public who didn't have a chance to sign up that would like to testify on House Bill 2039 today? All right. Please proceed.
Chair Witt, committee members, for the record, my name is Tom Wolf, Chair of the Oregon Council of Trout Unlimited, and I just want to be very brief. Trout Unlimited supports this bill, HB 2039. Many of our members are guides, and I've had a chance to talk with some of them over the weekends, and they are supportive of this. And getting back to what Stan Seal is, Trout Unlimited is a group, of course, that we want to provide wild fish and clean habitat to our streams. But one thing that I worry about is bringing in revenue to rural communities through fishing. And as Stan Seal so eloquently stated, guides are a lot of times are the ambassadors that guide people in those. And it's important that we have good standards of conduct for our ambassadors so that people can come out here and have a great experience in what I consider the most beautiful place in the world, the state of Oregon. And we urge you to support this bill. We think it's a very good bill that cleans up a lot of the standards for guides. And real quickly before I quit, is when I testified last, there was a reference made to my father and Representative Krieger. He was not arrested by Representative Krieger. He was Representative Krieger's high school teacher and coach. So I just want to clear that up. So anyway, thank you so much. And for your time.
Well, thank you very much, Sue.
Thank you. Chair Witt, members of the committee, my name's Sue Marshall. I represent Audubon Society of Portland, Tualatin Riverkeepers, and Willamette Riverkeeper, all of whom I think may fall into that gray area. And they offer a wide array of outdoor activities that are led by staff and also by trained volunteers, birding, paddling. It's part of their awareness education with the community. I would like an opportunity just to discuss with the Marine Board where the organizations might fall within this legislation. We did not participate in any of the meetings running up to this, but if there's a need for any clarifying language, we'd like to work with the Marine Board on that. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you very much, Sue. Going forward, certainly, whenever you have an interest, I want to make sure that if we've got groups working together, that we make sure to include all the voices. So,
thank you.
Tom, I particularly want to thank you as someone who comes from a rural district for pointing out the importance that this has on local economies. Thank you. Thank you very much, as well as thank you for the rest of your testimony. Questions or comments for this panel? I'm not seeing any. Thank you. Certainly appreciate that. Last and final call for testimony on House Bill 2039 today. With that, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2039. And folks, we're not going to work this bill because we don't have a fiscal as yet.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I'm going to have the Marine Board come back and address the question of the felonies.
Oh, thank you. I appreciate that. I'm going to reopen the public hearing on House Bill 2039 and ask the Marine Board to come forward. Thank you, Representative Klein.
Chair Witt, members of the committee, for the record, Scott Bruin, Director of the Oregon State Marine Board. In reference to Representative Clem's question, the wording in there is the wording that we did intend to be convictions of felony or misdemeanor. This comes up occasionally where we have a guide or an outfitter that is convicted of a felony or misdemeanor that's not strictly related to wildlife laws, but brings up some concerns for us about their fitness to be able to do this type of work. When you consider that guides and outfitters take people on multi-day rafting trips, that they take youth programs, take youth out, and that sort of thing, so there are some misdemeanors that do create an issue for us, and certainly not all of them, and maybe we can talk about what those are, but I'd like to read a couple of examples of some things that would be of concern to me if they're brought to me as misdemeanor convictions. So theft 2 is a Class A misdemeanor. That's stealing property valued at between $100 and $1,000. Assault 4 is a Class 4 misdemeanor. Intentionally, knowingly, or recklessly causing physical injury to another person with criminal negligence causes physical injury to another by means of a deadly weapon. There's a number of sex crimes in Oregon that are misdemeanors. Sexual abuse in the third degree is a Class A misdemeanor. Contributing to the sexual delinquency of a minor is a Class A misdemeanor. Custodial sexual misconduct in the second degree is a Class A misdemeanor. Public indecency is a Class A misdemeanor. Encouraging child sexual abuse in the third degree is a Class A misdemeanor. So those are some examples of the types of things that we would have a concern about and would want to be able to address when we're looking at people that are taking youth out, that are taking people on multi-day trips. But certainly we could look at narrowing this down to assault-type convictions, sexual-related convictions, or theft-related convictions. We certainly would be open to having that discussion because I understand we're kind of opening up a pretty broad area that we may not want to.
Very good. I think that helps focus us in, and I think with good reason you're concerned with those areas. Any questions or comments?
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Vice Chair Esquivel, please.
Mr. Bruin, are you going to go ahead and then initiate and get a addendum to this when we work the next time?
Chair Witt, Vice Chair Esquivel,
to narrow that
certainly
down
would be
bit.
Happy to do so, to look at a dash one. If I know in our previous hearing you assigned us someone to work with that we could work on something like that, I'd be happy to do so, Mr. Chair.
I think that that would be a great thing to do.
Okay.
Not seeing any further questions or comments. Gentlemen, thank you very much. Appreciate that. We'll look forward to your amendment, and I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2039. Committee members, we have two bills left, and I think they're fairly straightforward, and we're going to be able to get through them in a timely fashion. With that, I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2247. And Beth, if you'd please tell us what this bill is about.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2247 would repeal statutes regarding the Gorse Control account and direct remaining funds to the general fund. It also repeals statutes requiring the use of agricultural experiment stations to eradicate algae and detrimental weeds and grasses from waters, and statutes requiring posting of cleaning requirements on certain ag machinery in weed-controlled districts. There's also provision related to the imposition of a civil penalty for violation of weed control statutes. There is no revenue impact, a minimal fiscal impact, and no subsequent referral.
Thank you very much. I probably should have had you read that before I closed the public hearing, because we lost so many of our audience, and they didn't know that the Gorse Control Bill was coming.
Would you like me to go out and let them know?
They may regret this. They may live to regret this. Welcome.
Good morning. For the record, Lisa Hansen, Deputy Director with the Oregon Department of Agriculture. This is the final House bill from the Oregon Department of Agriculture cleaning up our statutes and doing some elimination of old statutes that are out of date. And House Bill 2247 really corrects an oversight from a statutory cleanup we did in 2009 related to our weed control program. The bill simply repeals the statutes related to Gorse control and a Gorse control account that exists within OSU. In your written testimony, it says we believe there's a couple hundred dollars actually in conversation with Dr. Hilburn, who's with me. He believes there's nothing in that account, and I will verify that and submit amended written testimony for that little piece. The bill also eliminates a requirement for posting of noxious weed lists on farm equipment. Where that came from, we're not sure. Been on the books for a long time, but no longer seems to be appropriate, nor have we enforced it. And then, as I said previously, the final piece reconnects statutory civil penalty authority to our weed control programs.
Very good.
For the record, my name is Dan Hilburn. I'm Director of Plant Programs at the Department of Agriculture. Lisa did a very nice summary there. I'd be happy to give you some examples. The four statutes that we're proposing to delete are things that even the weed control experts in our department and at OSU didn't even know were there. It became apparent that they were there when we did the consolidation in 2009. So these are really just orphan statutes that are not serving any good purpose. I think it would be good to clean them up. And this oversight that Lisa talked about has to do with civil penalty authority for weed control issues. The statutes for weed control used to be in three separate chapters. We consolidated them. Two of the chapters had civil penalty authority, but the new chapter didn't. And so that was an oversight, I think, from me and from legislative counsel. We'd like to correct that. We don't assess a lot of civil penalties in the Department of Agriculture, but we do see it as an important tool. And a couple of examples of cases we've had where we could have used that tool. One was kudzu, an A-rated weed off Barberville Boulevard in Portland, where we had a landowner who just didn't want any herbicide used, and we didn't have any alternative to using herbicide. So we nearly had to go to court to get permission to do that. We did have to go to court in Jackson County to treat an A-rated weed there, an alyssum infestation. So every now and then we have people who do not want to cooperate for very important weed issues, and we would like to be able to say, well, yes, you really do need to cooperate with us, and if you don't, there's a fine that goes along with it. So we ask your consideration for this, to clean up the statutes and make them a little more easy to enforce. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Anyone on this bill? Representative Krieger?
Yeah, not a real problem. I just want to bring it to the attention. If the last part of that where you have a $10,000 fine for certain statutes dealing with weed control, if they're cited, they would go before administrative law judge. Is that right?
Mr. Chair, Representative Krieger, the civil penalties are an administrative action. Those people who receive them have the ability to appeal them and go through an administrative process. In our plant programs, we have, in my history, I don't think we have issued a civil penalty. We've used that enforcement authority more in some of our natural resource water-related programs, but it's there as a regulatory backstop.
Yeah. Follow up. Please. I just want to make sure we're aware. You know, some of these fines that DEQ and these other agencies have, the one you had on Claus and Oysters, $25,000 fine, you've got no jury trial, no appointed counsel, and you go through to, if you appeal, to administrative law judge that's picked by the agency. It's not a real balanced system to deliver justice, and we are looking at it in the Judiciary Committee. It's been ongoing. The State Bar is well aware of it, and we need to get the agencies to start thinking a little bit, too, about when something should rise to that height with no type of court representation. It really isn't very constitutional in my mind.
Very good. Vice Chair McEwen.
Chair Witt. In the spirit of full disclosure,
yes,
I feel compelled to let known to the committee that when I read this bill, I was very intrigued. Mm-hmm. In 1856, my husband's great-grandfather, his name is George Bennett, immigrated from Ireland, Bandon, Ireland, to be specific, and found his new home on the south coast of Oregon and founded Bandon, Oregon. And with him, he brought the Irish mint and the gorse.
He's the guy.
Oh, I think she needs to recuse herself.
He was a sheep rancher, and in Ireland, they use gorse as hedgerows to contain flocks of sheep, and it's very manageable in small areas. Yeah. When it came to Bandon and was used to contain flocks of sheep, it obviously had free rein in a very large geographic area, and it's become a huge problem.
Burn the whole town down.
So I'm delighted to see this bill come before us, but I felt compelled to let you all know that I do have a bit of a nexus with this bill. And when I called my husband last night, he was tickled to know that we're cleaning up the statute, and it's under the Department of Ag to manage gorse, and just wanted to let you all know that there is an issue here.
Thank you very, very much. Vice Chair Esquivel.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. As for Vice Chair McKim, I thought you were going to announce that your great-great-grandfather on your dad's side, on your husband's side, was the first one to post noxious weeds on his tractor.
I don't think he had a tractor. I think he had a mule.
Gotta put it on the mule.
Representative Clem.
We're going to put on Olus an article here called Town Destroyed by Its Founder's Favorite Garden Shrub. Bennett.
It's true. It's very true.
Burnt to the ground. I was talking with, Representative Whitson, please.
I just wondered if this will enhance or allow regulators on private property, when you're talking about these weeds, do you have the right to go onto the property now to spray them or whatever? And it, does this allow for greater access onto private property by whatever regulators you send out?
Chair Witt, Representative Whitsitt, the answer to that is that the county weed control people have that authority, and most of the counties with weed control districts have programs, and they do that sort of work. In the In the 2009 fix to the weed laws of the state, we did address that, and the state now has more authority than in the past to do that. The problem has not been with access, it has been with people who refuse to cooperate. And that's where we're really asking for another tool to, and I think another piece to this that's really important is that we have weeds of various priorities in the state. We have a weed board that sets those priorities. What we're really talking about here is the A weeds, the highest priority category, the ones that we really don't want to get out. Those are the ones where we really need to clean them up and get rid of them so that they don't spread. Things like kudzu, purple star thistle, Patterson's curse, distaff thistle, things that you're probably not familiar with because we're eradicating them or keeping them in very small areas. So those are the ones where we really need a strong enforcement tool so that we can get rid of them and not just suppress them or control them.
Representative Krieger.
Mr. Chair, thank you. This is a different thing. On the sudden oak death is not a weed, but it's required that if you have it, you're supposed to eradicate it. It could be enforced. Well, if the state of Oregon and the federal government don't have enough money to eradicate it, it seems improper to try to have an individual, whether he has a couple thousand acres or what, be saddled with a burden higher than what the federal government and state government could ever do. I don't want to see that happen. Gorse would be a good example of it because the South Coast is just literally covered with it. Private land, federal land, everybody's land, a lot of it's not even the type of land it is. There's access is extremely difficult. And the only control is herbicides. Well, it's right down to the Elk River. Good example. We just talked about the Elk River Sixes, same thing. So this is a major problem, and I don't know how we really get our hands around all of it.
Representative Witt and members of the committee, I have some comments since gorse is the weed du jour here. Gorse is an important weed, for sure. It's definitely one that we don't want to allow to spread further in the state. And the ODA's strategy for gorse is to draw a line in the sand at Florence, and anything north of Florence we treat as an A weed. We also have a line on the coast range, and anything east of the coast range, we treat it as an A weed. On the South Coast, it is everywhere, as you know. It's out of control, and it's not possible for us to do significant work there with the resources that we have. So it's a management issue there. It's going to be, it's too bad, but that's the reality. But we think it's smarter to keep it out of the rest of the state where it isn't a problem yet, and that's where we concentrate our resources.
Thank you very much. Anything additional?
Not seeing any. Thank you very much for your testimony. Is there anyone else from the public who would like to testify on House Bill 2247? Not seeing anyone, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2247. With that, I think we're going to take it out. And with that, I'd like to open a work session on House Bill 2247. Vice Chair McEwen.
Chair Witt, I move House Bill 2247 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Vice Chair McEwen moves House Bill 2247 to the House floor with a due pass recommendation. To that motion, discussion. I'm not seeing any. Colleagues, I'd just like to note, having talked with Representative Esquivel, that in terms of government efficiency, this committee did not need any kind of study about the half-life of a notice on a plow, a harrow, a disc. So we're they might say, plowing forward. So with that, seeing no further discussion, anyone object to, oh, wait a minute, no, excuse me, chair backs up. Would the clerk please call the roll?
Aye.
Representative
Clapper.
Aye.
Representative Wendt.
Aye.
Representative Unger. Aye. Representative Huber.
Aye.
Vice Chair McEwen.
Aye.
Vice Chair Esquivel. Aye. Chair Huber. Aye. Having received the necessary majority, the bill is moved to the floor. Now I am going to need a carrier, and I know that the sins of Vice Chair McEwen's grandfather weigh very heavily.
They do.
Thank you, Representative, for volunteering to carry that bill to the floor.
You will have questions.
I would be honored to carry the bill.
I'm sure there will be questions. With that, I'm going to close the work session on House Bill 2247. And we have next up House Bill 2616. I'm going to open the public hearing. Beth?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2616 would make producers responsible for payments to the Wheat Commission if the first purchaser of grain is outside of the state of Oregon, is federal or another governmental agency, or if the producer performs handling or processing functions for the first purchaser. There is a revenue impact statement in your packet, no fiscal statement, and there is a subsequent referral to the Joint Ways and Means Committee.
Very good. With that, I'd like to call up, please, Jana Jarvis. And I'm not seeing a boot.
Oh, I know. I'm making a little bit of progress.
Excellent. Good morning.
Good morning. Good morning, Chair Witt, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Jana Jarvis, here today on behalf of the Oregon Wheat Commission. You have before you House Bill 2616, which we want to thank Representative Clem for allowing us to bring forward to you. Purpose is to clean up some of the statutes in the Oregon Wheat Commission. In the 2011 legislative session, we folded the Oregon Grains Commission, which was governed under ORS 576. We folded it into the Oregon Wheat Commission, and there were some important references that were left out that have created some problems. I can walk you quickly through those different provisions of the bill if you'd like. But primarily, the purpose of bringing this bill is because there were some important penalty provisions that were left out. In Section 2, you see for out-of-state grain elevators, they are not required, because they don't respond to Oregon law, to assess the penalty and forward it on. So, but most of the out-of-state grain elevators cooperate with Oregon for producers from Oregon that take their grain to them. Vice versa, some of the grain elevators in Washington I'm losing it here. I apologize for that. But there's some reciprocity there is the word I'm trying to get out to you. In any event, there have been a couple of occasions where a grain elevator won't participate. So this refers back to the producer then, the responsibility to forward that assessment. In Section 3 and 4, we reinstate the penalty provisions that were left out when this statute was cleaned up. Currently, there are requirements to forward the assessment there, but there's no teeth in it. And so this reinstates those penalty provisions. Section 5 is new. And it came about as a result of, as long as we were opening the statute, we wanted to fix a problem that the Wheat Commission has. Presently, under their statute, they were not allowed to keep any of their reserve funds in any accounts larger than $250,000. And if they're keeping a year's worth of reserves, that meant that they had accounts all over town. And this would allow them to aggregate those in a major bank or to invest them in the state pool, which would allow for better management of those reserve funds. And there isn't, it isn't that they're trying to keep a lot of reserve funds, but there are some ups and downs in this business, and they want to be able to keep at least a year's worth of funds in, because they do participate in funding some of the state research programs at OSU as well. And lastly, Section 6 provides for a definition of grain that was in the original statute that got left out when this was forwarded. There are a number of crops that were referenced in the grains statute that are not being presently assessed, which I noticed that your revenue impact refers to. This simply defines those crops and allows, obviously, for the commission to, at some future point in time, to assess them, but they at present do not have any plans to do so. And with that, Mr. Chair, I would take any questions you might have.
All right, thank you. Questions for Jana? Yes, Representative Thompson.
I am extremely pleased with the work of the Wheat Commission, as we've had that discussion before. I am a little concerned about the provision to put canola and soybeans under grains provisionally. And I would hope that if we take that step to exercise fees charged with that, the Wheat Commission would first come up with a policy and direction to support those commodities as vigorously as they have wheat, so that it doesn't become a way to bring revenue into the commission without any serious attempts to promote or otherwise support in a likewise manner. And I think it's something that will bear watching down the line, and certainly if the Wheat Commission were to take up a position as a major proponent of those two fledgling industries, then I think a fee would be warranted. A fee without activity, I question whether or not that would be warranted.
Mr. Chair, Representative Thompson, canola is becoming a rather viable rotation crop in eastern Oregon. I know that you're going to hear a lot about canola this session. And by putting it in the statute, it means that I'll have to speak on the issue of canola this session. However,
that was what I was getting to.
Yes, yeah. I understand that. However, it does provide some very good benefits, particularly in eastern Oregon, as a rotation crop. At present, OSU is doing some research on canola, and that's one of the reasons that it's becoming a viable crop in eastern Oregon, and much of that research has been funded by dollars from the Wheat Commission. So I would like to assure you that the intent is not to collect revenues without promoting research on those commodities.
I trust that is true.
Representative Woodson,
I just have a clarification question. Is canola going to be used for biofuels?
Chair Witt, Representative Witt said it's being used for foods as well.
I was wondering if we're producing canola for biofuels and it's shipped to out-of-state containers, you know, where they're holding it. So this will make the growers responsible then if the out-of-state containers are holding it and they don't report it. Am I understanding that correctly?
Chair Witt, okay. Representative Witt said that is correct, yes. Okay. If they're shipping their product to an out-of-state point and that they would still be required to remit that assessment if there was an assessment applied on canola. At present, there is not.
Okay. Thank you.
Anything? Yes, Representative.
I would like to point out to good representative from Klamath Falls, it is unnecessary to export the canola from Oregon. It can be shipped to the processing plant in my district.
Very good. And you heard it here first. Very good, Representative. And I think we may hear when we get to the canola bill that it's in terms of return to the farmers, they're probably going to get more return going into cooking oils than they are biofuels. Mm-hmm. But I'm by no means an expert on that, so we'll wait until we hear from the experts. Jana, we also had a subsequent referral to Joint Ways and Means, and I'm not seeing any reason why this bill should cost us much of anything. How do you see it?
Well, Mr. Chair, that was my question as well. I questioned why it had that referral to Ways and Means. So
okay, probably unnecessary then.
Yes, I would agree.
Anything more? All right. Thanks very much. Appreciate your testimony.
Thank you.
I am going to. Is there anyone else from the public who'd like to testify on House Bill 2616? Not seeing anyone, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2616, and I am going to open a work session on House Bill 2616. I am going to, Chair recognizes Vice Chair McKeown.
Chair Witt, I move House Bill 2616 to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that the subsequent referral to the Joint Ways and Means be rescinded and the bill be placed on the consent calendar.
Vice Chair McKeown moves House Bill 2616 to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that the subsequent referral to Joint Committee on Ways and Means be rescinded and the bill be placed on the consent calendar. That's the motion before you. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Seeing none, hearing none, so ordered. I am going to close the work session on House Bill 2616. Anything for the good of the order? I am not seeing anything. One more thing before we shut down. Thank you. Almost missed it. I'm going to open a work session on LC 1006. For the consideration of introduction as a committee measure. Beth, can you give us just kind of a brief what this bill is about?
Yes. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, LC 1006 provides that a private entity that proposes an action that affects a core area habitat of sage grouse give ODF&W a certain report and specifies the contents of that report. Provides that if the department concludes the proposals for offsite mitigation specified in the report demonstrate beneficial effects that offset adverse effects to the sage grouse population, the department may not make a determination that prohibits the proposed action.
Thank you very much. Vice Chair Esquivel.
Yes, I'm pleased that we would bring this forward because the sage grouse has been something that's been on the brink of going one way or the other, and if we can enhance the habitat and if we can help the sage grouse in Eastern Oregon, it's a great commodity over there. There used to be a lot of them, and anymore there's very few of them, so I would like to see us go forward with this and help the habitat for that particular species.
Thank you very, very much. It's this is a measure that we discussed among ourselves yesterday. Vice Chair McKeown, don't want to put you on the spot. I don't know if you wanted to add anything.
I have nothing to add. Thank
you. Okay. Members, we viewed this as a very, very good bill. With that, I would recognize Vice Chair McKeown.
Chair Witt, I move that LC 1006, dated 10-9-2012, be introduced as a committee bill.
Thank you very much. Vice Chair McKeown has moved LC 1006, dated October 9, 2012, be introduced as a committee bill. On that motion, discussion. Seeing none, hearing none, is there any objection to the introduction? Again, seeing none, hearing none, so ordered. Beth, coming attractions?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, on Thursday you have four public hearings and possible work sessions scheduled. 2032 requires payments for offsite compensatory mitigation to the removal fill fund. sets forth requirements for how those are calculated. 2249 establishes the Willamette River Basin Bonneville Power Administration Stewardship Fund. 2649 removes the requirement that a grant to purchase Oregon food under the Farm to School program be allocated under specified percentages. And 2782 addresses commodity commission issues.
And it's all happening here Thursday morning at 8 a.m. With that, we stand adjourned. Thank you very much.